What, we have a national spelling? And in this large origin, we had a cross end that we had thing involved in the hip square, and we had four terms, and so on. And I was arguing for you that the issue here was you have your favorite theory of physics above the weak scale. If I can match C2 across many, many thresholds, the burden, based on experience with hierarchies elsewhere in physics, the burden is to show that the C2, the value that you need for the success of the standard model for C2, is stable under the matching across these thresholds, even if somebody tells you that you got there. So independent of why it takes that, the value of the fundamental theory takes the value it does, what we're going to demand is that this value for C2 and these effective theories that you match across all these thresholds is of the same order of magnitude. So not an enormous cancellation between some huge value at high scales and all the thresholds that have to lie between those scales and where we do the measurement for C2. And again, it's not it's logically possible that that's the way things could work, that you have this enormous cancellation, but there hasn't been any examples of where it did work like that in the history of similar issues in science. There's, as you probably all know, there's an anthropic take on this. Basically, the anthropic take would say that, well, let's live with cancellation. And with the idea being that if you have many, many vacua, that cancellation will happen in some. And if these parameters are all varying in different vacua, then there will be some vacua where the cancellation happens. And if there's a good reason why you can't live anywhere else, then that's the way things would work. And that's also a logical possibility. Because morally speaking, that's so the way that's phrased is that they would then say that there's no microscopic explanation for why these things are small, and it's more like an issue of the example that's often used is why is it true that the Earth and the Sun and the Moon have the same angular size heat from the Earth? There's no fundamental physics explanation of that, it's just a coincidence. Due to where we are. That's probably not the best example, but the better example is one which, where our lives depend on it. But I think it's fair to say that the hierarchies of scale in a Peckel Lagrangian, size of the Sun and the Moon aren't like that. I think the main message I'd want to get across is that anthropic point of view is a very radical point of view. But the conservative thing, if you have an explanation, that's much more in the tradition of the way science has progressed in the past. And so normally the way science progresses is that you continue conservative thing before you. It's when you can't do, when you can't find an explanation, which is technically natural in this way, that's the kind of thing that drives you to do something radical. But when you have the choice between a natural solution and an anthropic one, I think everybody would agree that the natural solution is the preferable one, although ultimately nature will decide. So for the hierarchy problem, there's lots of things you can do to try and solve the problem. And the reason you have that latitude or that leeway is that the scales that are dangerous to you are ones that are beyond our reach anyway. So you're fooling with things that we haven't seen yet. And it's just guiding how you think about what to expect. And people apply the anthropic arguments, not just because of how much they apply, it's just hard to solve too. Part of the reason why people take the anthropic issue so seriously is, first of all, they're reducing you lots of vacua to theories of quantum gravity, like string theory. But secondly, because of the cosmological constant problem, which is the one which is, this problem is similar in spirit to the one we just talked about, but it's much more difficult because the states that are giving you the large contributions are ones which you think you understand really well. So if you just repeat the story we had here, for here, so for C2, we had C2 experimental something like 100 GeV squared, and thresholds
particles of mass m, if they're with the Hubble, contribute like m squared. And that's the problem.
But because the masses involved are large compared to this, the thresholds you're matching across are unknown.
The problem with C0 is that its expected permanent value is 10 minus 2 electron volts, so 4 to the power. Whereas particles of mass m contribute like m to the 4.
By the same argument I gave before, if you calculate the vacuum energy of say an electron, so you take an electron in a loop, and you attach a graviton to it, say, and you interpret that as being that graviton is coming from the root g here, so zero momentum graviton. Or you calculate the vacuum energy in a bigger way, you take 1/2 each part of omega for all the modes. Anyway, you slice it. This thing gives you, well, I guess, this thing naively gives you something which is quantically divergent, but that's not the problem, I would say. The divergences are not the issue. You subtract those when you're normalized, you calculate some normalized quantity, but when you do it, when you match that quantity across many thresholds, M1, M2, and so on, the issue is not that. It's that you get something which is quantic in the mass of the particle, and so it's dependent on the physical things that you're matching across here. And the problem is that you know, the electron is already 10 to the, what's that, 10 to the 6 electron volts, the 4th power. So you're out by 8 orders of magnitude to the 4th power, so you're out by 32 orders of magnitude. So even the electron comes to the 32 times too large. So maybe there's complicated things in your, and maybe the vacuum has got some weird properties. Maybe you've got particles in your problem at high energies which are strongly coupled and they don't go like m to the 4th. That's not the issue. The issue is when we came to the electron threshold, the electron we know is weakly coupled and we know how it couples, and the electron is giving it a weight enormously too large contribution. So if you match C0 across the electron threshold, you find that it jumps by, there has to be a 32 decimal place cancellation between what you have here and the contribution electron to get value that you measure at the large. And if you include the muon, it's worse. If you include all the other particles you know the standard model, it's worse. And so if you get up to the weak scale, particles you know the weak scale, then it's 52 or 54 decimal place cancellation. But no matter how you slice it, the problem with the cosmological constant makes it so much harder is that the thresholds you're matching through are ones that you think you understand pretty well. And yet, your prediction for the stack of energy is off by what's measured. And the problem isn't that you're measuring a small, a specific numerical value. When you measure zero, that is also a problem. So, but if you kind of ask what the consensus of the field is, the consensus of the field is that there's, unlike there being three ways to approach this problem, I say that the consensus of the field is yet that there's, this is up for grabs. There's no really, there's nothing here which passes the ego test in the sense that if you find someone who likes the theory, typically that's the person who invented the theory. In this case, there's classes of things here which for many people have been converted. I have my own personal take on what this thing is, what the issue is here, and I think that, so let me give you that story just in broad brushstrokes, but with the caveat that that's not something which is it's not a consensus in any sense of what, if people took a poll from physicists, you would be finding that they're all agreeing with me here, but they're going to be pretty sad when they didn't, because this is the way nature works. So I think that the essence of the problem, so I want to tell you just briefly why I think there is one loophole in which you can look for a solution, and whether, so what the exact solution is, I think it has to be in that loophole somewhere. But it's the existence proof that you can, that it's not hopeless to try and satisfy this naturalness issue for the cosmological constant, but only if there are extra dimensions, and only if those extra dimensions are very large. So the reasoning is that the basic problem is we have two ways to think about C0. So So on the one hand, CNOT is the energy in the Lorentz invariant vacuum. Because CNOT, having a term like CNOT in the Lagrangian, which is by saying that the stress energy in the vacuum goes to CNOT. And that's the only Lorentz invariant answer you can get for Lorentz invariant vacuum, for the stress energy tensor. So this number, thing that's in the Lagrangian here, has an interpretation in terms of a vacuum energy because of this statement that just given that the vacuum is Lorentz invariant, we know that we're talking about a number like this, and then the conservation of stress energy says it's got to be a constant, so it's just some number. And direct calculations with loop interacting things lead us to believe that that number should be quite big. So statement number one is that Lorentz invariant vacuum energy C naught, and we think that that should be of order 10 to the fourth for contribution to particles of order whose mass is around. Now, the second statement is that a term like this, thinking of it like this way, it's a vacuum energy, but thinking of it in the Lagrangian, it's like a cosmological constant. And when you solve Einstein's equations are going to be something like R mu plus 1 half R G mu is equal to this constant, some number here, like G mu. And so this constant is an explicit obstruction to flat space. So C naught is an obstruction to flat space. And when you say that you've measured the cosmological constant to be this number, what you're saying is that you're measuring the curvature of space-time as measuring cosmology to be that small, to be consistent with this number being that small. Because what you're really measuring is curvature. So the essence of the problem is a thing which we think should be large, Lorentz invariant vacuum energy, is the same thing as the thing which we think should be small. And whether you put this on this side of the equation or you put it on this side of the equation, it doesn't really make any difference. And so that makes it sound like it's impossible to get around. And the assumption here is that make your four dimensions. If you have more than four dimensions, you have no reason to think that those dimensions are Lorentz invariant in the extra dimensions. If there are more, dimensions, then we don't have any evidence of Lorentz invariance in the extra dimensions. And because of that, the stress energy you can have that your curvature is responding to needn't be as simple as a constant. And so there's lots of examples where you can have energy on a brain or something where you have a four-dimensionally Lorentz invariant energy, which is localized in the directions transverse to the brain. So it could be it's exactly like a source. So the gravitational response will be position dependent rather than some uniform curvature throughout all of space. And if that's true, then there are lots of solutions to Einstein's equations with energy sources like that, for which the curvature in the Lorentz invariant direction is zero, and all the curvature is in the extra direction. So if the four-dimensional Lorentz invariant energy is localized in the extra dimensions, it can curve these extra dimensions. They're not forward for a reservoir. And so there are plenty of solutions that do that. If you have a cosmic string, for instance, in four dimensions, then you know that the curvature around the cosmic string is zero. And what happens is that there's a conical defect at the position of the string. But there's no curvature near the string. So that's an example which has a two-dimensional Lorentz invariant energy distribution, but where there's no curvature on the string is perfectly flat, and the curvature is off the string. So
you can do higher dimensional generalizations of this where you have four dimensions of the ones we live on, and every point of the four dimensions is a sphere in the x dimensions. And so if I think if I draw the x dimensions, every four dimensional slice is a point here, and there could be two of them for which there's a conical singularity or some singularity, but the point would be that there's lots of curvature in these x dimensions, and there's none in the four dimensions that are transversals. And solutions like that exist. That doesn't in itself solve the cosmological constant problem, because what the cosmological constant problem will ask is, if you have to re-ask it in this language, you have to say, there will be solutions which have four dimensions that are flat, there will be other solutions for which the four dimensions are curved, and you have to ask, what choices do you make to get the flat solution, which is the analog of the choice over here that the cosmological constant C naught was small. And once you've identified what those choices are, you have to ask, if I now start matching across thresholds and integrating out heavy physics, do those choices stay fixed? Because that's the analog of the choice here. So we want to ask, if we choose this to be small, it's a pine scale, and you start integrating out physics that's heavy, we want it to stay small. That was the naturalness criterion. And so you have to re-ask the question here. And it's more complicated because there's extra questions, I think, and that's why it's research and not known answer. But there is progress in this direction. I think it's fair to say that the end of the road hasn't been met yet. But there's at least a road to hold here, because you've got a loophole between the vacuum energy, which is large, and the curvature of space, which is not large. And that's the essence of the problem. So it only works, though, if the energy associated with these extra dimensions is comparable to the vacuum energy that's measured. And so that means that the extra dimensions have to satisfy that 1/r is of the order of 10⁻²⁰ electron volts. Irrelevant. Because otherwise, if the extra dimensions were smaller than that, there would be a range of scales within which you had a four-dimensional problem of why your vacuum energy was so small, which you can't solve anymore. You have the four-dimensional problem of the constant problem back in its form over there, where it's elasticized and kills you. So this requires the extra dimensions to be on the order of, 10 micrometers or something in size, which is just possible, but just possible if you're living on a brain. And tests of Newton's law are down to about 45 microns. So the smoking gun for this picture would be that these Newton's law, the deviations at 10 micron level or so. So I would say that this is a direction somewhere in this exponential context. There's potentially a mechanism, or it's certainly worth finding out if there is or not. And don't give up yet on technically natural constants. But it's something which we'll know very shortly.
So if we were to decrease the bounds on R, or the size of the extra dimensions, would we be able to say hide some of that, or have this cancellation happen in C naught in terms of the original action, or have a little bit of the cancellation such that it's not out to n decimal places, it's now out to less decimal places, sort of thing? Would this solve a problem where it's basically 10 micrometers after that you're done?
Oh, if you get to 9 or you're screwed, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's true that once you're near the borderline and the factors of 10, then to really pin that down, you need to know the shape of the extra dimensions. It becomes a detailed question. And I think that there's a gray area right around 10 microns. But I think that as you start getting systematically down compared to 10 microns, then the naturalness issue comes back, and it depends on how far down you go. Mm-hmm. So that's difficult to say exactly where. For me, I think that if you don't see anything happening at all, then I think this is whatever's going on, it's not something to do with extra dimensions. If there's a natural solution, it's something we missed before. And I don't know how that would work, but I think that's really something which gets you eventually. It may not be 9 microns. If you're down at below a micron, then I think it'd be.
Yeah.
Of course, when I get down to micron, maybe I'll say it's the 10th micron. Because you can't go, what people traditionally do is exponential, so you can make it whatever you like. If you just make it small and small and small, it can be a different problem that you have. And in this case, the reason you can't is that the dimension actually turns something good for you. And that there's a whole story here as to, so that's the issue then is, are they helping with the integrating other heavy long wavelength modes, short wavelength modes? And I in many situations, they are.
So that's what kind of keeps you from having something arbitrary. You know, you can't dial R because you're being tied to this observational size of these section edges. There are other issues that you have to deal with here. It's not like this is a market stuff. You have to ask, why are these dimensions stable? And why keeps these dimensions, why this, not something else? And so these hierarchy problems get re-asked in the sense that this is now a small number compared to the gravitational scale. So why is that stable? So that has besides this normalization story is part of it, is one issue, but a separate additional issue is stability dimension conditions. Or stability, if I set this thing up and I ding the system, is it something which is, would cosmology completely change all of a sudden? And I think it's probably true that this kind of a picture is not stable towards changes to the initial conditions. I think that's something which is a valid criticism of this kind of approach. But that personally doesn't bother me because this cosmological problem is much harder than that. And the Big Bang theory has a sensitivity to initial conditions. And that could very well be just a statement that what went earlier in the universe, whether the initial conditions are special or not depends on what happened earlier. And so if there was inflation earlier, then the initial conditions of the Big Bang may not be so unnatural. And so there may be a similar resolution here that you ask kind of what happens before late time cosmology. Whether there's an initial condition problem here depends on what's going on in the earlier universe, but you have much less information about what's going on in the earlier universe, so much more wiggle room than you have for the cosmological constant problem. So for me, I've drunk the Kool-Aid. My prediction is that this is what they're going to see. They're going to see this Newton's law deviating. They're going to see extra dimensions in the LHC. It's going to be great. You're going to be living in a whole amount of physics. And I told you first. Yeah, this possibility was on the table for a long time, but I think people think of it as a corner of parameter space, which would be cool. But there's no real reason that it should be true. Whereas I think that the cosmological constant problem is telling us that that's where we live. So I'll take small bets on whether or not it's going to happen.
I mean, you mentioned that. I mean, you still have the same problem that you have to explain why dimension is exactly
large
and why it stays large.
Yeah, and I have a storyteller too. So I think so a lot of these things I think I know how to do. But it's
there's a hierarchy problem too, right?
No, I think not in the same way. It's so that bigger question, since you asked about it, is so in this picture I have in mind what would happen is that you have to ask when you're asking why is the astronaut zero? You have to ask kind of as I integrate out various models. Who's giving me an energy if I see cosmology? And more or less, the hard part of the story is why are the things that are on these surfaces where we live, why are they contributing to the cosmological constant? So the electron, for instance, the normal things I'm selling it. And so that's not quite what you're asking, but let me see them with it first. So the story there, what's interesting there is that these extra dimensions do exactly what you're looking for, because if you ask any non-gravitational question about an electron or a particle on this brain, you're supposed to answer it in four dimensions because those things are trapped on the brain. So you can't get off the brain. It's only gravity that gets off. So the only thing you're modifying through the energy range from here to the weak scale is the gravitational response of things, because those are the only things that see the Earth's extra dimensions. And so it's kind of doing the right thing in the sense that all the things you test pretty well are not changing because you're on the brain. And it's only gravity that's changing. And so then your question is to get to your question, I have to tell you where is the non-zero thing coming from. And so it's kind of, where that's coming from is basically there's a story to tell as to why things in the brain don't contribute. That's something which is like the cosmic string. I think I understand why loops in the brain don't start giving you curvature here. The thing that's giving you a non-zero potential for R is really a field of the thought, right? It's part of the metric. And so it's essentially the Casimir energy of nodes in the extra dimensions that are giving you this kind of a contribution to potential. And so if you actually look at Casimir energies, if you did it for a torus, you would have found 1/r to the fourth for the energy you would have gotten from the from the from from unconventional grounds, the energy density would be 1/4, the stress energy four dimensions would be 1/4, coming from the mode to zero modes on a torus. But if you did it on a sphere, what happens is that you get 1/4 times logarithmic fractions, it turns out. And these, in principle, numbers are calculable given the details of the geometry of the extra dimensions. And the reason there's a log there is that there's a, if you have two extra dimensions, which you, so I'm zooming in now on a specific scenario. If you have dimensions this large, you can't have more than two of them that large, because there's some numerology that's interesting. The Planck scale is the scale of gravity in the extra dimensions squared times the radius in two dimensions. And with that choice for R and for the known Planck scale, this becomes the TV scale, the 10 TV. And if you had more extra dimensions than two, then this will become lower, and so you'd be lower than already. So this can only work with the two extra dimensions. But it's interesting that this Carnegie problem works with the same numbers for the cosmological Maslow problem. It turns out that's kind of didn't have to work for us. So given that, so that was telling me why there's two extra dimensions, not four. So the other ones could be there, but they might be at different scales. But with two dimensions, happens so you get six dimensions overall, and then a curvature cube term has a dimensionless coefficient. So you know, in four dimensions, curvature squared things have dimensionless coefficients, and Einstein has got mass squared. In six dimensions, curvature Einstein has dimensions of mass of the fourth coefficient. Curvature squared has a coefficient which is mass squared, and the curvature cubes are the ones that are dimensionless. And so they can get logarithmic divergences in particular. And so what happens is that when you calculate the Casimir energy on a sphere for which R is non-zero, you get a divergence which gets renormalized into the coefficient of this thing. And then this logarithm is the artifact of the fact that you renormalize at different scales. And that shows up as a log R. And you don't see that in a torus because the torus is flat, so that makes kind of a but it's generically there. And then if you went past one loop, you have a series of logs. And so if you look at the at the kinetic term for R, it comes from the Einstein action. And it looks like dr dr over R squared. And so the canonical variable is R is really e to the phi, and this becomes d phi d phi. And this potential then becomes e to the minus some number times phi in this term, and this is some polynomial in phi. And there's probably a phi squared term, and so on. And so what this does is this, the potential you're predicting is exponential, but this polynomial gives you kind of a shape to it, like the shoulder. But the shoulder, you know, if there's a hierarchy between these two coefficients of the order of 1 in 10 or 1 in 50 or something like that, so the order of 10-ish, then this shoulder happens at exponentially large values of the field phi. And so if you ask, so if B was of the order of 1/50th of A, then that shoulder happens when R is at 10 microns. This is a normal Planck test. And if you look at the cosmology now is being potential energy dominated. That's the dark energy. And that happens at the shoulder. So the shoulder, the question that you're asking becomes, why is the shoulder so far out? And this kind of language is far out because it's really the natural variable is it's a logarithm of phi. So you didn't need a big bar to get a very large radius shape of your potential. But you might have worried, well, so didn't you have to make a minimum here so it stops? And the answer is no, it doesn't have to. If you, your cosmology can work fine, the Hubble damping is so strong that when you come down, it's so slow that when you get here, you can be potential energy dominated for a while, even if you later on roll off. So you don't need to have a stabilization. The vacuum energy doesn't have to become a constant. It can just we might be on our way to six-dimensional flat space. That's what that says. So it turns out that there's a story that's plausible in this language that you wouldn't have been led to think about if you. There's a number of things that are very remarkable about this cosmology, because another thing that people will tell you is that if you have a field that's just light enough to be doing some interesting cosmology now, its mass must be really small when it's a separate natural drop from there, depending on how much it costs. And it happens that this is one of the few kinds of theories like this for which that's not an additional problem. That's actually the mass issue is the same as the cosmology constant issue here, so it's the normal natural issues you would have, it turns out you don't have them. And it's kind of amazing because you didn't have a lot of things to play with to make it work. So it has the kind of smell of rightness in the sense that it's the theory smarter than we are. And every time you get to something which still says it's going to kill it, there's a way it can work. So that's kind of partly why I'm pushing this out of the way. you push it back. Anyway, enough about that. So the other, what's fair to say is that there's no consensus with this. This is a big puzzle. It's the one fly in the ointment of this picture of things as effect field theory. This needn't be a problem, but it depends on what you see at the weak scale. And if you don't see something which is natural, that would actually be a telling us something very deep about the way physics works. So not being natural would be very radical here. And none of the three options that I told you about is what happens, and we learn something really important. The other one here, M Planck squared R, is natural already because it's got the biggest scale in town there already. But what about these things that are dimension 5 and dimension 6? Those are things that are not going to be unnatural. If the scales involved were large, then we'll never see them. But we know that things in the denominator don't have to be large. The smallest mass denominator can win. And so if you're looking for things beyond the standard model, maybe the thing to do is to look at this to say, what kinds of things could you expect to see here? Because those might be good things to look for, because whatever you have at high energy, as long as it has the part of the front end of the standard model and the scale is not too high, then you'd expect to see things in this list. And the ones that you'll see first should be the ones that have the smallest dimension, all other things being equal. So if you ask, so you can ask, in the same way that the standard model was the list of the most general gauge invariant things at dimension 4, you can ask, what's the most gauge invariant combination of things involving standard model fields at dimension 5 that you can break out? It turns out there's only one thing you can write down. There's a unique SU2, 3 plus SU2, SU1 invariant dimension 5 direction. So that's interesting. There's only one thing you could see at the dominant 1 over m level. So this will appear with some coefficient which is of order 1 over m, and this would be some coefficient of order 1 over m squared on dimensional grounds. And this unique dimension 5 thing is some coefficient L and K, M n, and I'll divide by some scale m just to on dimensional grounds. And then it's got something, it's got two leptons in it. So it's m left L. And two big so you can track the SE2 indices in the only way you can. So this involves particles we don't see, the Higgs, the particles we do see. And so the only way we would know, until we actually discover the Higgs particle, if we knew, the only way we would know that this interaction was there is to ask what it means for the lepton. So if we restrict the Higgs to its excitation value, which is only 0V, at the dimensional order of 2, then what happens is this turns into K, and for M, you get two factors of V, plus 2, and then this becomes neutrino. These MNs are generation indices, as we've written LN. So, in the absence of seeing the Higgs particle, the only way you would know this kind of dimension 5 thing existed would be it would be giving you a mass of neutrinos. That's a neutrino mass. And so one of the most remarkable things that happened in the last 10 years is, actually more like 15 years now, is that over the 90s, evidence built and became compelling for the existence of neutrino masses. And so it's remarkable that if you say, how do we know the standard model is not the whole story, there's about three or four things that tell us that we're missing something in the standard model. One of them is that there's evidence, robust evidence now, that neutrinos have a mass because they oscillate. So neutrino oscillations. Good evidence for masses. So that's kind of remarkable. That says that the first thing that you should have expected to be around as a deviation from the standard model is one of the few things as it doesn't seem to be deviating from the standard model. And so you can ask kind of how big these coefficients would have to be to account for the masses that people see. The way people see these masses, I'm not sure how much details you guys know, but you know, solar neutrinos is one way they see these masses, that they if you have masses like this that are a matrix in flavor space. So this runs over the first generation, second generation, third generation. So a new M would be, you know, new E, new mu, new tau. And in the standard model, there's nothing which the electron number, muon number, and tau number are accidental conserved charges. And so reactions in the standard model, the dimension 4 and less stuff, don't convert these guys into each other. But this kind of an interaction, which involves different generations all mixed up, does ruin those conservation laws. And so when you diagonalize these masses, what happens is that the burden of the mixing goes into the W couplings. So the W mu, what you used to get was an electron coupled to electron neutrino, and you had a muon coupled to the muon neutrino, and so on. But now what you get is some big matrix. This works. And so you have reactions where it used to be that any time a W produced an electron, it always produced one specific neutrino. Now you have an amplitude producing any of the neutrinos. That's what that kind of thing does. And so that means that the way neutrinos are really hard to detect because they interact so weakly. And so you might ask, how do you know anything about neutrinos at all, given that you know, they're it goes light years of lead before they scatter once. The way you know something with neutrinos is that there are particles that decay always into them. So if you hit pions are produced copiously in any strong interaction. And a pi plus always decays, 100% of the time it decays to a mu plus and a neutrino. And pi minus is the same thing, but different than a neutrino. And so it's easy to make beams of pions. And the fact that the weak interactions are weak just means the pions live for a long time. But a long time on particle physics scales means they live for a microsecond. So less than that actually keeps them nice. And so every time they decay, they produce a neutrino. So you make a beam of these things, and then they decay into neutrinos and muons, and then you put a big pile of concrete or something, and that stops everything but neutrinos, and neutrinos are right on through, because you need light years of that stuff to stop them. And then down here you make a detector, and then every once in a while what happens is a neutrino hits something, and does another reaction like this, it scatters. You don't see the neutrino that comes up, but you do see what it produces, so it might produce an electron, say. And in this case, if these are pions, and the pions are producing muons, and if these were always muon neutrinos, which is what would be doing the standard model, so you had some reason to believe these are muon neutrinos, and what you'd always find is muons here, you never find electrons here. That was kind of the evidence that these things were conserved, like a number of muon number of tau number. But what happens really is that the muon itself then decays into electrons and another electron neutrino. And so sometimes you do get electron neutrinos down here. But you can kind of figure out how many of them you should get. But you can identify, it used to be that you would identify the neutrino according to the charged particle that you did see in the reaction. And so what happens now is that because of the evidence for neutrino masses is coming from the observation that if you had a process here, say you had a process which involved a reaction where a muon is decaying, so you know that let's say it's a pion decay. So supposing you have some reaction where the reaction up here, the process is produced in the neutrino beam width, tells you that this is a muon neutrino, and then what's happening is down here you used to always see muons, but now you're actually sometimes seeing electrons or some one of the species that you didn't expect to find related to the muon. That's because this matrix is non-zero in the standard model, in the standard model with the second term. And so the properties of this matrix are being explored by these experiments. And the most famous one is where the reactant here is the sun. So the sun is full of nuclear reactions, and those reactions are typically fusion. And so you're converting many protons to helium, and that involves turning some protons to neutrons. And that reaction
the balance charge had to have a positron, and then the balance electron number, there had to be a neutrino there somewhere. So this, in the standard model, would always be an electron neutrino. So people on Earth would have tanks of water looking for these neutrinos. They interact very rarely, but you get a whole tank full of stuff for it to react with, and it will occasionally react, and they then look for the electrons. And the electrons, a nuclear reaction has, you know, MeVs worth of energy, so the reaction here gives these electrons MeVs worth of energy, so they're relativistic in water, say, and so you can see the Cherenkov radiation they produce. And they were finding that you know how many of these reactions are happening in the sun because you know how bright the sun is. So that's not quite true because you don't see all the neutrinos from the sun. But the upshot was that the number of electrons being found here was systematically small compared to the number you knew were being produced. And what nailed it was, in Sudbury, they made a reaction which checked to see if you got reactions with muons being produced, if you had the other species of neutrino involved. Wasn't because of producing muons, but they had ways of identifying if because they use heavy water in the detector, you have reactions where you can dissociate the nucleus of heavy water using these other neutrinos that would normally not interact, and show give you electrons. And when you look for them, you find that the sum of the electron plus the muon plus the tau neutrinos adds up to what you expect from the sun. So there really is, in that case, evidence for these neutrinos, all three of them being produced by these reactions that only involve electrons on that side. And that's, you know, there's four or five measurements like this now that you can do the same kind of experiment where you produce these neutrinos on Earth and look for the same kind of effect. There's a similar thing where cosmic rays hit the atmosphere, they produce pions, which decay into muons and electrons, and so you get neutrinos from that. And the abundance of muons versus electron neutrinos is right when you look at the ones coming from above. The ones on the other side of the Earth, where the neutrinos come through the Earth, they have the long relative abundance. Again, that's evidence that they're turning into the species, one species is turning into the other species. I mean, that's unheard of. What's going on is that every pion gives you a muon and a muon neutrino, and the muon decays into electron neutrino, and a muon neutrino. So you're expecting two muon neutrinos for every electron neutrino, basically what they expect from the atmosphere. And these pions are being produced in a cosmic ray, which the proton hits a nitrogen or something in the atmosphere. And you do get this 2-to-1 ratio coming from above, but you get a 1-to-1 ratio coming from below. And again, that's accountable for if the reactions are such that you're not actually getting precisely this number of. There's actually an effect where the neutrinos know that they're moving through the Earth, and there's a matter enhanced transition that happens. So there's a body of evidence here that I'm kind of skating around. Which says that neutrino masses, there's evidence for them. And it's striking that that they would be predicted. And the size of these masses is typically, because you're looking at comparisons of different kinds of neutrinos, all you see is mass differences. But the mass differences are typically of the order of 10 to the minus 2 electron volts or so, very much like the cosmological constant, which is interesting. And so if you were to ask if K was of the order 1 here, since we know how big V is, because that's the Higgs gap, which is, you can measure that in the standard model, and you can figure out what M would be. So if K is order 1, and V, remember, is something like 100 GeV, then V squared over M is supposed to be something like, this is 10 to the minus 11 GeV, because the GeV is 10 to the 9 electron volts. This is going to be something like 10 to the minus 11. That says that M should be something like V squared over 10 to the minus 11 GeV. So that's 100 squared is 10 to the 4. That's 10 to the 8. So that's an interesting number because that's kind of in the ballpark of where grand unified theory is supposed to be. This is assuming that K is order 1. If K were some coupling constant, say K is instead of order 1, maybe it's in the order of some coupling constant square, maybe it's a 4 pi or anything like that. And as K comes down, then M comes down, because you really have K V squared over M, and so this is really M over K. So the smaller K gets, the smaller M gets. And so depending on how small you think K is, you might see smaller numbers than this. People talk about the size of neutrino masses. So one thing that's interesting is that that's a similar scale to what I mentioned earlier on when talking about grand unified theories. there may very well be things going on at this scale. And the unifying of the companies may be telling you something about that, maybe not. But there's reason to believe that things like barrier number could be violated and Lepton number could be violated at those scales. And so it's not, it's kind of interesting that if you did have Lepton number being violated at those scales, then that would give you the right ballpark size that you would need to describe these neutrino oscillation experiments. Paradoxically, given that these masses are so small.
So can you just say again why is that these interactions by that left? I mean, obviously, why can't K be diagonal?
Well, there's two separate issues. One is there's the independent electron, muon, and tau number. Mm-hmm. And so you're probably happy that if this is not you're probably not happy. You're saying if it's diagonal, your intuition is that these things should be, this is going to go like e to the I theta, and this is going to be e to the minus I theta. And then those will cancel if it's diagonal, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that my intuition is hiding up what's going on here. So what's really, the way, what I've written here is, if I wrote this in terms of Dirac's spinners, the way that you're used to thinking about them, would that, the Lorentz invariance of this thing would be, because these are both left-handed, what this would be the conjugate of the neutrino field R times the neutrino field. So it's got a complex conjugate twice. So what happens is that they both rotate by the same phase. So even if it was diagonal, then it would break the left-handed number.
The dimension factor gives mass to neutrinos, but does it also imply a change of mass for the electrons? Because you've got the L here.
No, it doesn't, because the zero here is what hits the electron, and so you only get the neutrino, turns out. And the way you could tell that is that if that were not true, it would mean that this thing was, because of the same argument I just gave, this would not be electric charging, right, if we had electron on both sides. And so the whole thing is going to be guaranteed to be electric charging, right? And it's just a little bit deceptive because of this fact that it's really a conjugate field that's appearing there. My notation is hiding the fact that this is not the standard mass term.
So sorry, but it's not just a convention to write H as 0 and J, it's always the same.
No, it's a convention. But in the same convention, though, once I told you that, I told you where the neutrino and the electron. So if you switch that convention, I have to switch this one. So this is making it look like this goes with the electron, and that's because I'm not telling you how the SE2 indices get contracted here, and there's an asymmetric tensor that goes between this and this to make it invariant. That's the I've skated over a bunch of things that are in there. But if you ask what would I need to make this thing SE2 for SE1 invariant, and you'll see that this is I have the choice of H or H star or what they call H twiddle, which is H complex conjugate times the asymmetric matrix, and these are the guys that are actually appearing there. And so what happens is that this guy gets paired off with the neutrino. If you're careful about the SE2 invariance.
So could you also say that, like, the fact that the neutrinos have the left arm versus the violet, not electrons, but that's a sign that the Higgs mechanism is right or something?
When we're saying electrons, you mean that you don't see left arm number violating effects with electrons?
Yes.
So things like, mu goes to E gamma or something like that. If you were to see our lepton number violating reaction like mu minus goes to e minus gamma, that's like a lot of like conservation of things except lepton number. Then certainly the Santa module would not predict this to be observable. It would happen at some level where you have a muon could produce a W, and then a muon neutrino, and then this some sort of a mass appears and makes it into electron neutrino, and that becomes electron. So there'd be some loop that could generate this, but the loop would make it so incredibly small on top of the neutrino mass you could see in here that you'd never see that. If this was all that was going on in the world, you'd never see this. So if you did see this, then what you have to see is not just the number in this term, it's the number violation somewhere else too. So there's ways you could test that what you're seeing is this or not. So there was one more point I want to make with this mass. One thing is, so what's unsettling a little bit about this is that the selling point was supposed to be that we look at these higher dimension operators, and because these are in the denominator, it's the smallest mass that wins. And so you might have hoped that what we're going to find, once we found these operators, if we find them to be non-zero, we're going to learn about the mass that's the closest to the standard model, the first ones we haven't seen. And we've got a really, really big mass there. And so that doesn't mean that there's a desert between here and there, that there's no particles at all whose mass is lighter than that. And that's because this thing breaks lepton number, the statement was always the lightest mass wins all the things being equal. But if there's a selection rule that forbids you from contributing, so if we have particles that are at 100 GeV, but their interactions preserve lepton number, when you integrate them out, you can never generate this thing because this has a lepton number delta L equals 2 selection rule, and the physics you're integrating out is lepton number invariant. So what can appear here will be the lightest mass that is capable of producing a delta L equals 2 interaction. And so if this is what's going on, this would be saying that whatever the physics is that's breaking lepton number is probably at very, very high energies. And there could be lots of physics lower than that, lower energies than that, but whatever that is, it can't be violating lepton number. For many reasons, it can't be. If it was there violating lepton number, you'd see things like neutrinos, beat gamma, you'd be seeing possibly protons decaying, and things like that. So you shouldn't be disheartened that because this scale is very, very large, that over here you're going to find that all these guys are incredibly suppressed by two powers of that big scale, so you'll never see these guys. What will happen here is that we should take these guys and divide them into classes. They'll be the ones that break these, that satisfy delta B is not zero and delta L is not zero, and so on. We should find those, because those are the ones that very likely have to be suppressed by a scale which is something like 10 to 15 GeV. We're going to see that there are things like this. There's six operators in the dimensional six list that violate variant number and lepton number. They happen to all preserve B minus L, it turns out. But they, in particular, allow the proton to decay, and consistency with the proton lifetime says that this scale, whatever it is, has to be at least something like 10 to the minus 10 to 15 GeV. So for these guys, the scale that you're pointing to here, M has to be at least as large as the one you're finding here. So there's consistency between those guys for those kind of operators. But for the ones that don't break any selection rules, like B equals 0, B equals delta L, these guys, they can have coefficients which are much, the M is going to be much, much smaller, because particles that are much, much lighter than this, that can't contribute to these particular operators, these ones, can give you dimension 6 operators, and most of the operators at dimension 6 satisfy this selection rule. And so there can be lots and lots of things to look for here, where this mass could be much, much smaller for these guys than for these guys. And so in that sense, this fact that these guys are suppressed by a big mass and these guys by a small mass is like the neutrino photon story I was telling you at the very beginning, that the selection rules control what the lightest mass is that you're allowed to get in the process, and that can make a big difference to the size of the effects that you get. So let me just, maybe that's a good place to leave that. I have a list of the six operators. Yeah, maybe this kind of discussion. No, it's not there. What's surprising is that there's actually so few of them. So there's a, but you know, the maybe things I'll steer you towards these notes, because there's things that are qualitatively of the form. There's an old one which is there's various things about it. If they're all four fermion things, there's quark, a lepton, a down quark, and an up quark. There's another one which is quark, up quark, and a right hand lepton. Another one which is quark, and lepton. Another one which is quark, and lepton, but the SE2 attraction is different. Another one which is down quark, not quark, not quark, quark, and lepton. Another one which is up quark, not quark, down quark, and lepton. And that's it. And then there's a unique way of combining all their indices to make a message plus one invariant and one invariant. So these are all the only ones that are delta B equal 0 and delta L equal 0. And if you just by exhaustion check them, they all satisfy the delta B equal delta L. And equal, that those are equal to plus or minus 1. Because they all involve 3 quarks and 1 lepton. So and each quark is variant number a third. So the fact that there's a few of them actually allows you to say things with the selection rules. Things like the grand unified theories of I told you about, they tend to actually, if you actually calculate which ones you get, you tend to get a few of these things. And so, depending on the pattern of the things that you see in program notation, if you see it, you could tell which of these operators was the most important one. And each of these things can have a generation dependent, like n, m, p, q, with some coefficients that are in generation space. So this could be either the up fork or the top fork or the charm fork. This could be the electron, the tau, or the muon, and so on. And so depending on exactly the relative size of the k products, you have some sense of which ones are important. And spin 1 particles tend to give you these particular operators, and spin 0 particles give you different combinations of operators. So you can pick them apart by looking at what kind of operator you see should be able to see for that. Should we be some left cases to see for that? So that's probably a good place to stop. And that would be the end, unless someone has something they want to hear about the Shannon model.
Yep. Are you guys heading off right now?